From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we celebrate the 70th birthday of America's greatest living theater composer, Stephen Sondheim. We listen to an interview from our archive and hear some of his music. Also today, growing up in Spanish Harlem, we meet writer Ernesto Quiñones. He's making his literary debut with the novel Bodega Dreams. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers why the border between irony and sarcasm has become so fuzzy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In Indian-controlled Kashmir, security forces clashed with Kashmiri separatists in Srinagar. The fighting came as President Clinton addressed the Indian Parliament in New Delhi and said India should resume a dialogue with neighboring Pakistan over the disputed region. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports.
Indian security officials say they killed two separatists who occupied a building of the border security forces early this morning, but only after the building was burned to the ground after attempts to dislodge the intruders failed. Three Indian troops were killed and several more injured in the confrontation. It came just 2 days after gunmen killed at least 35 Sikh villagers about 40 miles south of Srinagar. No one has claimed responsibility for that attack, but India's National Security Advisor, Brajesh Mishra, says India has information that two separatist groups based in neighboring Pakistan were involved. The attacks were evidently aimed at highlighting the Kashmir issue during President Clinton's visit, but in his address to Parliament today, the president said he had no intention of mediating the dispute. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, New Delhi.
Pope John Paul II visited Bethlehem today, where he was welcomed by Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat. The 79-year-old pontiff prayed at the grotto where Christian tradition says that Jesus was born. Arafat greeted the Pope by saying, "Welcome to our land," and John Paul responded by saying that the Palestinians had a natural right to a homeland. The Pope also visited a Palestinian refugee camp, but after he left, hundreds of rock-throwing demonstrators clashed with Palestinian security forces. Witnesses said they were reacting to heavy-handed crowd control by the police. One of the world's preeminent physicists, Freeman Dyson, has won the Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion. Dyson has written extensively on the meaning of science, especially its relationship to religion and ethics. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Dyson has written and spoken out against the view that science and religion are incompatible, and he's criticized religious creationists and scientific materialists as equally dogmatic and insensitive. He believes both fields should join forces and drive the world in the right direction. Dyson has argued that science must reorient itself away from an elitism that favors toys for the rich, such as tiny cell phones, and find a more egalitarian approach. The renowned scientist is an emeritus professor of physics at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey. He is not a church member, but he regularly attends a Presbyterian church there. The Templeton Prize was established in 1972 by mutual funds entrepreneur John Templeton to highlight a field omitted by the Nobel Prizes. Winners are awarded $940,000. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
The Dow Industrials lost 40 points today to close at 10,866 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. President Clinton said today that he's looking forward to signing a bill that eliminates the Social Security earnings cap for people who keep working past the age of 64. The Senate unanimously passed a measure that allows older workers to keep collecting Social Security no matter how much they earn. With the popular diabetes drug Rezulin about to disappear from pharmacy shelves in the U.S., people who use the drug are being advised to consider alternatives. NPR's John Hamilton reports.
The FDA announced Tuesday that Rezulin is being withdrawn because of its links to liver problems. That leaves more than 500,000 diabetics in need of other medications to control their blood sugar levels. Rezulin has been popular because it helps the body use its own insulin, allowing many diabetics to avoid insulin injections. Now, the FDA says Rezulin users should look into other drugs. Two possibilities are Avandia and Actos, new drugs that appear to offer the benefits of Rezulin with less risk. Other options include injected insulin. FDA officials say Rezolin users should keep taking the drug until they can meet with a doctor to choose a new medication. John Hamilton, NPR News.
The Miami relatives of Elian Gonzalez are fighting a federal judge's ruling that could send the 6-year-old boy back to his father in Cuba. The Miami relatives filed an appeal yesterday and appeared today on television talk shows, saying Elian's mother wanted him to be in the U.S. Elian's mother and 10 other Cubans drowned when they tried to reach the U.S. by boat in November. In stocks today, the technology-rich NASDAQ Composite Index gained 153 points, or 3.4%, to close at 4,864. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Something appealing, something appalling, something for everyone, a comedy tonight.
That's Comedy Tonight from A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, the first Broadway musical with music and lyrics by Stephen Sondheim. He is America's greatest living music theater composer and among the best who ever lived. Sondheim turned 70 today. We're celebrating by listening back to some of his music and to a 1988 interview with him. His musicals include Follies, Company, Merrily We Roll Along, Sweeney Todd, Pacific Overtures, Sunday in the Park with George, and Passion. He has won all the big prizes, including the Tony, Oscar, Grammy, Pulitzer, and National Medal of Arts. Sondheim's mentor was lyricist Oscar Hammerstein. Sondheim started his Broadway career writing lyrics, first for Leonard Bernstein's music in West Side Story, then for Julie Stein's score for Gypsy. Let's start with a song from West Side Story, the Jet Song.
When you're a jet, you're a jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet, if the spit hits the fan, you got brothers around, you're a family man. You're never alone, you're never disconnected, you're home with your own. When company's expected, you're well protected. Then you are set with a capital J, which you'll never forget till they cart you away. When you're a jet, you
In 1988, Stephen Sondheim told me that he didn't like the idea of starting his Broadway career as a lyricist.
No, I was trained as a composer, and that's what I wanted to do. I'd majored in music, and I'd studied music on a scholarship with Milton Babber for 2 years. And it was an accident, and I wouldn't have done it except that Oscar thought it was a good idea for me to do it, because Bernstein and Jerry Robbins and Arthur Lawrence were seasoned professionals, and I was, 25 years old, and he thought it would be a good learning experience for me. And he was right.
Those are the first lyrics you wrote that got performed on Broadway. They've become classics. When you listen back to them, how do you feel about them?
I didn't like them then, and I don't like them now. And there are two lyrics I like. The rest of them sound very written to me.
Which ones are the ones that you like?
Something's Coming and the Jet Song. The others are, they're very self-conscious. But that was partly Lenny's influence, because he very much wanted the show to be important, and that to him important meant that the lyrics should be, quote, poetic, and his idea of poetic and mine are different, and I think what he really wanted was purple prose, and I wanted simplicity, which is what I'd gotten from Oscar. So I think the lyrics are very self-conscious. I was bending over to please everybody, of course, because I was so young, and so I find, except for the occasional line, I think they're pretty embarrassing.
You worked with Julie Stein on Gypsy. You wrote the lyrics for
that. The next show, yes.
Now, in his autobiography, he said one of the things he liked about working with you is that you never asked for extra notes. does that mean, like, if you find a three-syllable word that you think is just perfect, that you beg the composer for two extra notes?
No, well, no,
this,
no, actually, no. I think. first of all, most of the lyrics in Gypsy, the music sort of followed the lyrics. That is to say, I would write sample quatrains or couplets and give them rhythms to work from. But in fact, I'd never do that anyway. When I work with a composer, I've only worked with three, but once in West Side Story, I asked for extra syllables. I mean, a number of the tunes in West Side Story were taken out of Candide, that were not used in Candide. One of them was a song called One, which was composed of dotted half notes, and it went one hand, one heart. But I said, when we got to Washington, I said, it's just too few notes there, and the words just too heavy and too pretentious, and at least, you know, if you give me three-quarter notes instead of one dotted half, I would appreciate it. Well, the lyric's still pretty pretentious, but it's not as pretentious as it was. Maybe Julie had that from other people. I don't believe in, though, like everybody else, I often tend to be verbose. When I write lyrics, I try to fight against it. And I remember Oscar used to set me exercises in theory and say, you know, write a whole note melody and a whole note lyric, a whole note meaning, you know, where you have to sustain a note, like he wrote a song called Who with Jerome Kern. Who stole my heart away? Well, if you hear that tune, it's hard to set that lyric because you've got to find a word where the singer can sustain the vowel sound and where it's natural punctuation, and it's hard to do. And I think most lyric writers tend to be verbose, and I think that's what Julie was probably referring to, was that, you know, I'd been trained quite the reverse way. Not that there aren't wordy lyrics in Gypsy, but there aren't very many of them.
When you started writing your own music, did you feel like you were carrying on the tradition of Rodgers and Hammerstein in any way, or did you feel like you were breaking from them?
Oh, no, it was Rodgers and Hammerstein, certainly, absolutely.
What about what they had done felt like what you were doing? What is the tradition exactly?
Oh, it's a tradition. It's something Oscar really started with Showboat. He combined the whole European operetta idea with the American musical comedy idea. And the American musical comedy idea was, you know, a series of songs with jokes in between. And the operetta idea was a series of, you know, Graustarkian situations with outlandish romantic variations on them. And essentially an excuse for singers to let forth with large romantic or choral pieces. And with Showboat, he attempted to bring some realism into the musical theater and to combine the two so that they became what you could call a musical play. Not an opera, but a musical play. And somewhere between an operetta and a musical comedy. And that was not taken up very much by other people during the 30s, and Oscar tried a few himself, and they failed. So it wasn't until Oklahoma came along and was such a gigantic success that the movement was resuscitated. And after that, virtually everybody started to write what they call integrated musicals, in which the songs carry the story forward instead of just being respites and moments between jokes and block comedy scenes. And that's essentially what I was doing.
I want to play one piece that you've written, and this is from your opera Sweeney Todd. And I thought it might be interesting to...
It's nice to call it an opera, but please, let's call it a musical.
Call it a musical. Yeah, why would you prefer that to opera?
Well, because it doesn't belong in an opera house. Though it's mostly sung, there's a good deal of dialogue in it, and I'd say about 20% is dialogue. And it's not for operatic voices. It's not about the singer. Operas are about the singer, not about the opera.
Yeah, why don't you like to write for operatic voices, by the way?
Because they push it. They're interested in the voice and not in the material. And I'm interested in the material. And that's just the way they're trained, and that's what audiences come to hear. Audiences do not come to hear the piece, they come to hear the singers.
Well, from Sweeney Todd, what I've chosen to play is a part called The Epiphany, and this is a part where the whole character of the main character changes. Throughout the show, he's been interested in revenge against one person, and it's a kind of just revenge that he's seeking. But when his revenge is thwarted, he becomes pathological and is interested in killing anybody who enters his barbershop. He'll take any head that walks in. This is a turning point. Before we hear it, just tell me a little bit about the challenge that writing this presented to you.
Well, the piece is based on a play by an English playwright named Christopher Bond, an excellent version of this story, which has been told for 130 years, 150 now. And it's always been a kind of 19th-century melodrama with blood and guts and thunder sheets. And as such, it was always very uninteresting till this young playwright, Christopher Bond, a British playwright, got hold of it in the 70s. He was with an acting troupe, and they were going to put it on for their Christmas show. And they read it. The scripts arrived a little late, and they read it, and they only had 3 weeks to go, and they realized how terrible even the last version was, which would have been, I think, 1956 was the last version that was written. So he said, don't worry about it, I'll rewrite it. And he rewrote it, and he changed, kept the essential plot, which is about a murderer, mass murderer, and who kills people in his barber chair, and whose colleague, Mrs. Lovett, turns them into meat pies and becomes the most successful entrepreneur of meat pies in London as a result. And he motivated it by giving Sweeney Todd this whole revenge motive, which was never, ever part of the story. And the only difficulty he had in motivating the whole play was turning the personal revenge into mass revenge, which, of course, didn't matter in the originals, because in the originals he was just this kind of crazed, greedy murderer who killed people for their money. And that was not the case with Bond's version. And I had to figure out some reason to justify the moment. What Bond justified the moment with a single sentence, which even he admitted was sort of a weak stab, which Sweeney said, in effect, I've tasted blood and now my thirst is great. And I'd never bought that, and neither, I think, did Chris Bond. So I try to think of a reason that he would turn from being a single-minded murderer into this kind of crazed mass murderer. And I came up with this notion in the Epiphany, which has to do with the social situation and really has to do with the lower classes and the upper classes, which is something that Bond, who was and is a sort of left-wing playwright, had touched on but hadn't used for this particular moment. And what Sweeney does, in effect, is blame the world for his difficulties, for his problems, for the rape and suicide of his wife. And, in fact, he's right. And so to blame the social structure for his personal tragedy gave me the key so that he could then say, and now I will kill everybody in the social structure, high and low. And that's what it amounts to.
Okay, let's hear the part where he has this revelation, this epiphany. This is from Sweeney Todd.
There's a hole in the world like a great black pit, and it's filled with people who are filled with shit, and the vermin of the world inhabit it. But not for long. Human race, Mrs. Lovett, there are two kinds of men and only two. There's the one staying put in his proper place and the one with his foot in the other one's face. Look at me, Mrs. Lovett, look at you. Though we all deserve to die, tell you why, Mrs. Lovett, tell you why. Because the lives of the wicked should be made brief for the rest of us. Death will be a relief. We all deserve to die. And I'll never sir, how about a shave? Come and visit your good friend, Sweeney. You, sir, too, sir, welcome to the grave. I will have vengeance. I will have salvation. Who, sir? You, sir? No one's in the chair. Come on, come on! Sweeney's waiting. I want you, breathers. Sir, anybody, gentlemen, now don't be shy. Not one man, no, nor 10 men, nor 100 can assuage me. I will have you. And I will get him back, even as he gloats. Time I'll practice on less honorable throats, and my Lucy lies in ashes, and I'll never see my girl again. But the work waits. I'm alive at last, and I'm full.
Len Carreyrou from the original cast recording of Stephen Sondheim's musical Sweeney Todd. We'll hear more of Sondheim's 1988 interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Today is Stephen Sondheim's 70th birthday. Let's get back to our 1988 interview with him. You know, it seems to me that in all your songs, you always bring in very specific elements of the drama that's going on.
Yes, well, I'm into that. I'm into sort of naturalistic songwriting. And like The Worst Pies in London, in that show, you know, I worked out where she's dusting, blowing dust off her pies and slapping roaches and things like that. It's all worked into the music. Each slap and each blow, and I like working that kind of thing. And it first of all, it helps the director to give him a very specific blueprint of what the action should be, so that if he wants to change it, he can, but he has something to work from, and he doesn't have to turn to you and say, well, how do I fill this moment? And I like to, I think it's fun to write songs, you know, for people who have colds or who stutter or, you know, who cough or who can't remember what they're saying, the kinds of things we do in real life.
Is that why you like to work in the setting of Broadway shows? Because there are details of a story to work into a song. It's not just a generic love song. There's characters.
Oh, yeah, sure. That's exactly why, yes. I'd much rather write for character and situation. I wouldn't know how to just write a song because I would have to invent a character in a situation if you asked me to write a song. The few songs I've written, like, for, I know, people's birthdays and things like that, that I've written apart from dramatic situations. I've had to invent the dramatic situation or take it out of a real-life situation.
Have you ever taken a lyric of yours and changed it because you thought it was too clever?
No, I've taken it, yes, I have, when I think the audience isn't getting it, or when I think it's out of character. I did it in Into the Woods. There was a nice couplet in a song called No More, and it was very graceful, and it was too graceful for the character. Yes, I will take it out sometimes, not often, because I usually do that in my study while I'm writing it, when I think that it's either out of character or when I think that it may be something difficult for the audience to assimilate quickly, because the whole point of a song is, as opposed to a poem, which you can read at your own speed, the lyric goes by at its speed and you have to catch up with it. So it's up to the lyric writer and the composer to make it clear to the audience, at the same time not lag behind them nor be so far ahead of them that they get baffled. So sometimes you have to underwrite lyrics for just that purpose. You have to give them air and you have to make the lyrics simpler than you would if it was on paper.
I know that you collect puzzles and you're interested in puzzles. Is lyric writing similar to a puzzle?
Oh, sure.
And the problems you have to solve?
All art is. All you have to solve it. Same thing as with a painting or with a novel. I mean, you're always solving problems of structure, architecture, and things like that. In lyrics, I think it's more critical because there are so many fewer words. I don't know what kind of I just violated some basic speech. So many fewer words. But at any rate, there are fewer words, and therefore each one becomes important. Also, since I believe in writing lyrics that reflect the inflection of regular speech, the rise and fall of the language, and how long you sustain a word in a given line becomes, to my ear anyway, critical if you're trying to give the impression of naturalistic speech. One of the problems with Sweeney Todd was I didn't want the audience to laugh at this melodrama. I mean, we do live in the 20th century, and people don't go for this kind of blood and thunder stuff anymore, and it's much more horrible out on the street than it is on the stage. But I also didn't want them to think that they were, quote, at an opera. So one of the triumphs for me of Sweeney Todd is I look around the second act at the audience's face. They don't know that people are singing. They really think they're talking, because they're so involved with the story and what's going to happen next and who's going to get killed next, they don't realize they're being sung at. And that's a result of lyric writing being so seeming like dialogue. And that kind of stuff comes through a lot of sweat, and that's what working out a puzzle is.
One last question. A lot of composers really love to play their own stuff at parties and to get on the stage whenever anyone will let them and perform. You seem to rarely perform your own work. You don't like to perform?
No, I don't. I performed a lot when I was a kid. When I was in When I was at George School, I played some recitals around Pennsylvania, and I also acted a lot while I was in college. And one day I just woke up and thought, what am I doing in public? And from then on, I always wanted to hide in the shadows. I'm not a performer by nature, and except privately. I like to play the piano for friends, or particularly for a collaborator. I like to demonstrate a song, but I do it when I have to, but it's something that does not give me a kick at all.
Well, I thank you very much for spending some time with us. Thank you.
Righto.
Stephen Sondheim recorded in 1988. Today is his 70th birthday. As part of an ongoing celebration this year, the Museum of Television and Radio is presenting a retrospective of his work that has been broadcast on TV. And in May, the New York Philharmonic will stage a concert performance of Sweeney Todd. Let's listen to a song from the cast recording of Sondheim's 1994 musical, Passion. We'll hear it, Donna Murphy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I wish I could forget you, erase you from my mind. But ever since I met you, I find I cannot leave the thought of you behind. That doesn't mean I love you.
That doesn't mean I love you.
I wish that I could love you. I know that I've upset you. I know I've been unkind. I wanted you to vanish from sight, but now I see you in a different light. And though I cannot love you, I wish that I could love you, for now I'm seeing love like none I've ever known. A love as pure as breath, as permanent as death, implacable as stone. A love that like a knife has cut into a life I wanted left alone.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From virtualrelocation.com, an online resource for moving and relocation, featuring cost of living comparisons and virtual city tours at virtualrelocation.com. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House's Crown Division, publisher of The Gilded Dinosaur, The Fossil War Between E.D. Cope and O.C. Marsh and the Rise of the American Science by Mark Jaffe. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on why irony is out, sarcasm is in, even though people can no longer tell the difference between the two. And Ernesto Quiñones tells us about growing up in Spanish Harlem, the setting for his first novel, Bodega Dreams.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Don't be sarcastic. That's what parents used to tell their children when they made wisecracks or talked back. But now the word sarcasm doesn't seem to be negative anymore. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has these thoughts on whether the meaning of the word has changed or if people have a new attitude towards sarcasm itself.
I got an email from a friend of mine. She was very excited about this guy she'd started seeing. He has a great sense of sarcasm, she said. I was a little taken aback by that recommendation. I thought of writing her back to say, gee, if I were the guy, I'd have waited till later in the relationship to let on to that. But I knew I was thinking in terms of the old economy sarcasm. For a lot of people nowadays, sarcasm doesn't have to be cruel or cutting. It's just a cover term for pointed humor of any kind, from satire and parody to simple banter. There's not much trace left of the original meaning of a word that's derived from the Greek words for tear the flesh. What I interpreted my friend as saying was that the person had a great sense of irony. For those of us raised under the old dispensation, that was an important distinction. Both sarcasm and irony involve saying the opposite of what you mean, but with irony you're winking at your listener, where with sarcasm you're sticking out your tongue. The first is a private joke, the second is a public ridicule. Why did the boundary start to get fuzzy? At one point, I thought it had to do with the fact that people have gotten a little unclear on the other meaning of ironic, the way you say, isn't it ironic, to acknowledge how fate can frustrate our expectations. Nowadays, a lot of people seem to use the word with no sense of piquancy or ruefulness. It's just a synonym for coincidental. I hear sports announcers doing this all the time. Ironically, he was wearing a borrowed jersey the last time he kicked a 50-yarder. But it turns out that people have been using ironic in this loose way for more than 100 years, and up to now, it hasn't dislodged the other uses of the word or blurred the line between irony and sarcasm. And on reflection, I don't think that what my friend is suffering from is just a semantic confusion. If the word sarcasm is replacing irony, it's because that's what's going on out there. Wherever you look, irony's moving out and sarcasm's moving in. Johnny Carson was ironic, David Letterman is sarcastic. Peanuts was ironic, South Park is sarcastic. Andy Warhol was ironic, Jeff Koons is sarcastic. Come to think of it, Seinfeld was pretty sarcastic, too. That's why it surprised me when Jedediah Purdy described the show as irony incarnate in his provocative recent book, For Common Things. Purdy went on to argue that the show represented a sensibility that's eroding the sense of trust and commitment in American life. But America did just fine under the reign of irony. If you were bent on seeing Seinfeld as a threat to the Republic, it could only be as a representative of the new decriminalized sarcasm. It's troubling to think that Purdy himself might be shaky on the distinction. It's a sign of just how far we've fallen. The best model I can think of for the shift from irony to sarcasm is the way the novel Emma was transformed into the movie Clueless. In fact, if you were making up a banner for the new sarcasm, you'd write as if on one side and whatever on the other. But then, almost all the recent Jane Austen movies allowed themselves a lot more sarcasm than the novels did. The extreme example was Mansfield Park. It turned the novel's priggish heroine into a version of Jane Austen herself, only a lot prettier and bristling with sassy retorts, somebody who wouldn't have been out of place as a regular on Ally McBeal. It was something of a revelation for people who'd never thought of Jane Austen as somebody you'd describe with the adjective in your face. But that's what's happened everywhere. Sarcasm's gotten winsome, irony's gotten old. There isn't much point to being ironic in an age that puts such a premium on knowingness, when everybody's in on everything. We can't all wink at once. And there's really no need for the obliqueness of irony either, now that we've cast off all the inhibitions that the ironic sensibility festered in. Irony's always been the recourse of people who weren't allowed to say what they mean. But who needs indirection when the New Yorker's publishing four-letter words? For people who were raised under the old regime, of course, the new forms of sarcasm can take some getting used to. My generation was force-fed on irony. I pull down my college paperbacks of Austen or Fielding, and I keep finding the word irony written in the margins. And it can still make us uncomfortable to hear somebody say, well, duh, we tend to read it in a cutting way. But really, it isn't like that. When the line between the words begins to blur, the difference in intention does too. Sarcasm, irony, it's all just high spirits now. I'm not concerned when my 10-year-old daughter tells me, in your dreams, Dad. I know she means it in the nicest way.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Coming up, Ernesto Quiñones talks about his new novel, Bodega Dreams, set in Spanish Harlem, where he grew up. This is Fresh Air. Bodega Dreams is a new novel about a young man in Spanish Harlem who's trying to get out of the neighborhood. Bodega Dreams is the first published novel by Ernesto Quiñones, a writer in his mid-30s who has taught fourth-grade bilingual English. Like the narrator of the book, Quiñones grew up in Spanish Harlem and is half Puerto Rican and half Ecuadorian. Let's start with a reading from Bodega Dreams.
It was always easy to get into fights if you hated yourself. So what if you fought a guy bigger than you who will kick your butt? So what if you got stabbed with a 007 in the back and never walked again? So what if someone broke your nose in a fight? You were ugly anyway. Your life meant zero from the start. It was as if you had given up on the war and decided to charge the tanks with your bare fists. It's nothing brave in it. You just didn't care anymore. It was easy to be big and bad when you hated your life and felt meaningless. You lived in projects with pissed-up elevators, junkies on the stairs, posters of the rapists of the month, and whores you never knew were whores until you saw men go in and out of their apartments like revolving doors. Fires, junkies dying, shootouts, holdups, babies falling out of windows were things you took as part of life. If you were a graffiti artist and people knew you were a good one, death meant an opportunity to make a few bucks. Someone close to the deceased, usually a woman, would knock on your door. Mira, my cousin Freddy just passed away. Can you do him a rest in peace? You know, a rip? So you would bemoan Freddy's death, whether you knew him or not, and say you were sorry, and that's what had happened, like you really cared. Freddy, she would say, Freddy was shot by mistake, man. He wasn't stealing nothing. You nod, and then ask the person on what wall she wanted the rip, the rest in peace, to be painted on. On the wall of PS101, she would say, the schoolyard, you know, the back wall, the one that faces 111th Street, Freddy will hang there all night. I wanted to say, Freddy, the best of 109th Street, rest in peace. And then I wanted to have the flag of Borinquen and a big conga with Freddy's face on it. Can you paint that? You would say, yeah, I can paint that, and never ask for the money up front, because then you wouldn't get tipped. I painted dozens of ribs for guys in El Barrio who felt small and needed something violent to jumpstart their lives and at the same time end them. It was guys like these who on any given day were looking to beat someone up. So it was up to me to either become like them or get the hell kicked out of me.
That's Ernesto Quiñones reading from his new novel, Bodega Dreams. You did those rips, those rest in peace graffiti things for people in the neighborhood who died?
Yes.
How did you start doing them?
I always loved graffiti, and spray cans were very popular in the 70s. It was part of a crew. You would have a crew, which was like a little gang, and wherever you went, you would carry a spray can. And you would write the name of the gang or the crew. So if your name was the Spanish Connection, which was our name, it was up to me to make sure that wherever we went, I would write the Spanish Connection. And from then on, I moved on to rips.
Were there a lot of people you know who were killed that you ended up doing graffiti memorials for?
Yeah, I did a memorial for Sapo, who actually was one of a friend of mine. And Sapo died when he was 14. And in my book, he lives to be older. But in the neighborhood, what happened with Sapo is we used to fly kites on the roof. And we used to fly them with beer. So sometimes we would get a little tipsy. And I guess one day he must have been flying up there by himself, and he must have gotten a little tipsy, and he fell off the roof. And so he died at 14. And where we lived, the house was surrounded by these gates. So he fell on top of those gates, and he was impaled by the gates. Right on the spikes, and it was not very nice to look at.
What was your memorial painting for him like?
It was him flying kites, because that's what he loved. He loved flying kites. He was a little chubby, so I had him flying the kites and smiling. And everybody that knew him would pass by, and they would either light a candle, drop a rose, drop a 16-ounce beer or something.
Where'd you paint it?
I painted it right on the same wall where he fell behind the gates. I climbed the gates, and then on the wall which there was a window right on top of it. I painted the rib right underneath it.
Do you still paint?
No. Now I basically do writing.
Would you describe the neighborhood that you grew up in?
The neighborhood I grew up in was actually, you know, I can't complain. I had a great time, even though I did know that there was some really nasty stuff happening, and sometimes it would bite me and it would bite my family. Coming over here, I was thinking about the day when my mother got mugged, and she came upstairs crying, and me and my brother, we rounded up some of our friends when we got some bats and we got some bags so we can go look for them. And I remember why we brought the bags, and the reason you carry the bags is so the police would think that you were going to play baseball at a vacant lot. And we went looking for these guys, and we never found them, so we all had to go back home, and we were really frustrated. And then there were other times when you were watching television, and you were eating, and you were really into the show, and you were really into your food, and your mom would go, "That's your sister calling. She's downstairs. You got to pick her up because there's a rapist, you know, in this building somewhere." So you had to leave your plate of food, you know, put on your coat. It's freezing outside. You got to meet your sister downstairs. You got to walk her up the stairs, you know, to make sure that nothing happens to her. And we hated that, but that was part of the living in El Barrio.
How many flights did you have to walk down?
Depends where we were living. So we lived in a couple of buildings. The one that I really hated was the one in the sixth floor, and that was rough, especially when I was watching, like, Starsky and Hutch, you know? And then I had to leave, and I'm like, oh, man, you know, why doesn't her boyfriend bring her up, you know?
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Ernesto Quiñones, and his new book is called Bodega Dreams. One of the main characters in your book, Willie Bodega, makes his money selling crack, but then puts some of the money back into the community, detox centers, he subsidizes low-income housing. He's a very ambiguous figure. You describe him as a representation of all the ugliness in Spanish Harlem and also all the good it was capable of being. Would you describe this character a little bit more and who, if anyone, he was based on?
Actually, Willie Bodega was based on real-life characters and also on literary characters. I'm going to start with the literary character. The literary character that I used as a model for Willie Bodega was actually Jay Gatsby, who was poor. He was a hoodlum, and he was in love with Daisy, and Daisy left him to marry someone with money, which was Tom Buchanan. So in order for him to have the same status as Tom Buchanan, he sold booze, and he became a big bootlegger, and that's how he made his fortune, and now he was ready to go and fight for Daisy's love.
This is the Great Gatsby.
This is the Great Gatsby, yeah. That's basically what the book is. In a nutshell, although it has other themes. But Bodega does the same thing. He was in love with a girl from the neighborhood who married a rich Cuban family, and now he became a big drug lord selling all types of drugs, and now he has enough money, enough stature to go and fight for her love. What he's doing that Gatsby didn't do, and there's a line in Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby when the father says he would have built the place. But I didn't see Gatsby build anything. All he did was throw parties. So what I did was my Gatsby started building the place. He actually did. He actually took renovate abandoned buildings that the city of New York totally neglects to this day and renovates them and puts people who need low-cost housing to live there. And he also has this dream of starting a great society of Latino professionals. The other person that I base, Willie Bodega, was in a real-life character in El Barrio. His name was actually Willie Vasquez. And he was a gangster, and he was in a lot of racketeering things. But then he met this guy, and Harry Quintana was actually a Harvard architect. And those two got together. The Harvard architect got together with the gangster Willie Vasquez, and they started the Real Great Society. And it was a program. It was a group of people that recruited a whole bunch of, or anybody that went to college in Spanish Harlem. And they recruited all these Spanish Harlem college students to help teach the East Harlem dropouts.
So do you see the character of Willie Bodega in your novel as a really ambiguous figure, someone who is, you know, both really evil because he sells crack and good because he helps renovate the neighborhood?
I see him more a representation of almost everyday life, or if you want to go... of American life or the United States, it can do some great good, and it can also do some horrible evils too. And I base Bodega on that.
Did you read a lot as a kid?
No, I actually painted a lot. I knew actually my painters before I knew my literature. And not just the famous one. I knew the obscure ones, too. I love the Latin American muralist. I love the Mexican muralist. I loved a painter from my father's country, from Ecuador, Guayasamin. I loved him. I loved the Puerto Rican painter, Ollero. I loved him. I loved Campeche. I loved also Picasso and the regulars, Matisse, Miró. I love Sheila. So I loved both cultures of painting. And it was only when I got older, when I was in my early 20s, when I went to City College, that I started reading through a professor that I met named Frederick Tutton, who introduced me to all these great books that I should have read. And I remember seeing some of those books in my high school, but I didn't really pick them up.
When you were really into painting, did you go to the museums, or were there other ways that you saw the work of the painters who you liked?
I went to the museum, but I also went to this place called Taller Boricua, which is now the Julia de Burgos Cultural Institute at 105th Street and Lexington Avenue. But it used to be, it was very nomadic, so it was always changing because they were always losing some sort of funding, so they were moving. But they were the ones that actually took me under the wing when I was like 16, 17, and I learned a lot from them. And I would also take workshops at Museo del Barrio. They would offer drawings or painting or sculpting or some sort of workshop, and I was always signing up, hoping that they would pick me. And once in a while, they would pick me, and I was very happy about that. When I would go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, there was always this sort of uneasiness because I thought the guards were like after me or something. So sometimes I would go with a friend and we would dress up because that way they wouldn't look at us so bad.
Did it
so
make
we wouldn't
a
wear our sneakers.
Do you think?
I don't know, but it made me feel better. You know, I couldn't just go with my sneakers, you know.
So when you decided to start writing, how did you end up getting published?
I don't know. That's God smiled on me. I have no idea. I met Gloria Loomis through, City College was very good to me. City College didn't just show me books and educated me, which is a great tradition because it was for the workers. City College was for the poor. The education, college education for the poor. It's called Poor Man's Harvard, it was called. It's had some valleys, and maybe it can rise up to a higher standard now, but it's still good. It's still good. I'm proof of that. I met Walter Mosley, who's a mystery writer there, and he was teaching a course, and he's actually a student of Frederick Tutton, the same professor who introduced me to great books. So through him, he said, well, when you finish with that book, let me look at it, and I'll show it to my agent. And I said, sure. So I gave him Bodega Dreams, and he gave it to his agent, and she said, you know, I like this. This is very good. And she decided to represent me. But before that, because it might sound like a overnight success, before that, I wrote another novel. It was titled The Slow Death of Lobsters, and nobody wanted that novel. So, and that was like 3 years before the Bodega novel, before I wrote the Bodega novel. So I was rejected a lot, and I was rejected a lot by agents, too, not just publishers.
My guest is Ernesto Quiñones, author of the new novel Bodega Dreams. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ernesto Quiñones. His first novel, Bodega Dreams, has just been published. Tell me what some of your favorite movies and TV shows were when you were growing up that you think helped kind of shape you.
You know what? I used to like this guy called Dolomite, and he was an African American who was just trying to get by, and the cops were always setting him up, And they would set him up so that he can work for them, so he can go into places that they couldn't go. So they were actually using him sort of like an infiltrator. And he will always, at the end, actually get the cops back instead of helping them. And what we would go see these movies, which were called blaxploitation movies, and Dolomite was my favorite. And we would wait intensely for this line. And the line was, stop Whitey. And every time you would hear that line, we would all go, yeah! And the whole theater would just go, yeah! And to us, that was very exciting. He was sort of like a James Bond character, too, because instead of saying Bond, James Bond, he would say Dolomite, you know, Dolomite, Mother Fletcher, you know. And then we were like, yeah! So he was big. Dolomite was big.
What else?
We also liked Starsky and Hutch. We liked Beretta. We liked those cop shows. For the movies, there was this other movie called Cornbread Maxwell and Me about a basketball player. And he was from the ghetto, and he was a very good basketball player, but at the end he gets shot because the ghetto drowns him. So to us, that was also a big movie. There was another big movie for us. It was called The Warriors. It came out in 78 when we were in junior high school. And wow, when we saw that one of the kids had a spray can and wherever they went, he would paint a W, we knew that. We said, you know, we thought the W was cheap because it's easy to do a W. What we would do is actually do the whole logo, because every crew had a logo. And we understood what was happening. And in The Warriors, it's basically about a guy who, I think it was Van Peebles, Mario Van Peebles, is the leader of a big gang, and he calls all the gangs of the city together so they can unite and become this big power in the city. And then someone kills him, so then they kill the visionary, they kill the leader, and they blame the Warriors. So now the Warriors have to get home to their turf, which is Coney Island, all the way from the Bronx. And the whole movie is about them coming from the Bronx all the way to Coney Island through all these obstacles, a gauntlet of gangs. So they fight their way through all these gangs. And that, to us, was a big movie.
In your novel, the main character, the narrator, really wants a nickname. And he, you know, he finally gets one. Did you have one? And was that important to you?
Yeah, I was actually Chino, and it was important. And, you know, it's in...
Same name as your character.
Yeah, same name as my character. Actually, the first chapter is pretty autobiographical. And then the others just sprinkled around it. But when I was... Goodfellas came out like in 1990 or 91. When I saw that movie, there's a part where the narrator, Ray Liotta, is saying, everybody had a name. There was Johnny Two Times. And the guy goes, got to get the paper. Then he goes, there was Nicky Eyes. And there was the guy, Pete the Killer. And then he goes, yeah, I took care of that thing for you. There was this guy. So they had names too. And I'm saying, you know, Italians were in our neighborhood as well. They were in Pleasant Avenue. It's really an old thing that you got to have a name. If you want a personality, you got to have a name. And especially if you're an outcast, especially if you consider yourself an outlaw. If you want the respect, you got to have a name.
So how'd you get yours?
I got mine because Bruce Lee movies were really popular. And there were a lot of Chinos, but it wasn't a name that was just given to you. And I mentioned that in the book. Chino was like a honorable name, sort of like for an Italian mafioso to be called Fats. He's not going to be called Fats if he's skinny and has no, you know, no sort of reputation for being mean or something. So Chino was like that. You had to look a little bit Chinese. You had to have some sort of Asian looks, and then you also had to fight. It doesn't matter if you won or lost. You just had a fight, sort of like Bruce Lee. So there was a couple of Chinos, and that was one of them.
If you don't mind my asking, the character in West Side Story that shoots the romantic lead is named Chino.
Right, and he was probably the only Spanish in the whole movie. Then again, he might have not been, but he looked Chinese too. He had the cheekbones.
That movie have any impact at all?
No, we hated West Side Story. We liked the music. There's this Puerto Rican comedian who had a very sad life and committed suicide named Freddie Prinze.
Yeah.
His son is now doing these teenage movies, Freddie Prinze Jr.
Right.
But Freddie Prinze would make fun of that movie. And one of the things he would say was, Tony is yelling for Maria and only one window opens, you know, which is Natalie Wood. When in fact, a whole bunch of windows should open if you start yelling Maria in Spanish Harlem.
If you teach again... And I realize that you're not sure if you will now, because it depends on how your writing career goes. But if you teach again full-time or part-time or, you know, fourth grade or college. Do you think it will be a good thing for your students that you're published, that you know, you love writing and reading so much that you've published?
Yeah, I think it'll be good for the students and for the whole Latino community. I get very happy when I see a Latino being published. I get very happy when I see a Latino being a director. I get very happy when I see that my people are being represented. To me, that's important, and I think it'll be important to them too. The funniest thing about when I heard that I was going to be published, I told my parents that I was going to be published, and I've been at this for a while. So my parents were like, "Yeah, okay, that's good. You're not going to quit your job, right?" And I said, "No, I'm not going to quit my job." I said, "All right." And then when I told my kids that I was going to have a book out, they all went, "Yay! Our teacher's going to be famous." But my parents didn't do it, you know, but my kids did. Because to my parents, the most important thing is that I have a job, you know, that I support myself. Well, the kids saw it more as this is something cool. This is something elegant, you know, this is something prestigious. So I think now publishing has the opportunity to publish a whole bunch of Latino writers, you know, not just me, but others, you know. And it's not on fertile ground. There are other Latinos like Juno Diaz, Sandra Cisneros, but they're far and few in between, and I think we need more of them.
Well, Ernesto Quiñones, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Ernesto Quiñones is the author of Bodega Dreams. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producers today were Roberta Shurrock and Joan Tui Westman. Audrey Bentham is our engineer. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne Maria Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Maria, Maria, Maria. I've just met a girl named Maria. And suddenly that name will never be the same to me. Maria, I've just kissed a girl named Maria, and suddenly I found how wonderful a sound can be. Maria, say it loud, and there's music playing. Say it soft, and it's almost like praying. Maria, I'll never stop saying Maria.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Princeton University Press, publishers of The Eternal Darkness, a personal history of deep sea exploration by the oceanographer Robert Ballard. In bookstores or online at www.pup.princeton.edu. From Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at SaabUSA.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. And from Random House's Delacorte Press Division, publisher of Losing Julia by debut author Jonathan Hall. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actress Joan Cusack, co-star of such films as Broadcast News, Working Girl, In and Out, and Runaway Bride. She's in the new movie, High Fidelity, which stars her brother, John Cusack. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.